Hey everyone, welcome to the Mobile User Acquisition Show. In the Mobile User Acquisition Show, we feature interviews with the smartest folks in mobile and growth who share invaluable, actionable, tactical insights on every aspect of mobile growth and marketing, not to mention some adjacent areas just as well. The Mobile User Acquisition Show is presented by me, Shamant Rao, CEO of the mobile growth marketing firm Rocketship HQ, and produced by Karishma Sundaram, our superstar content marketing manager at Rocketship HQ. Each episode includes strategies, tips, and pointers from the leading edge of mobile growth marketing that you can use to unlock tremendous growth for your app in a sustainable and capital-efficient manner.
Our guest today is Sophie Vo, studio and game lead at Voodoo and founder at Rise and Play, a knowledge-sharing platform for leaders in the gaming industry. In today's conversation, we talk about Sophie's experience building a new gaming studio focused on producing casual games within Voodoo, a company that's much better known as in the hyper-casual space. In today's conversation, Sophie tells us about how she started building her studio from scratch and the completely unexpected challenges she had to face along the way, about the skepticism she faced about her business model, about the fundamental differences between casual and hyper-casual games, which she realized could threaten the future of her studio, and about the ticking clock that her team was building against. She talks about the shock of the pandemic on her then-budding team and the emotional upheaval it caused. She talks about the critical conversations she had to have with her leadership and her own team when she realized that there were questions that were being asked about her studio, and she would have to justify a lot of her decisions that she was making. This is an incredible what's and all behind the scenes conversation, and I felt this was such an inspiring and instructive look at how Sophie operates, especially since she's incredibly candid and transparent about her challenges and struggles as much as she was about what she did to confront a lot of these challenges. We are so glad to bring you this interview with Sophie today.
I am very excited to welcome Sophie Vo to the Mobile User Acquisition Show. Sophie, welcome to this show.
Hi.
Yes, Sophie, very much excited to have you, certainly because I have read a lot of what you have written and spoken about. And I think a lot of that's very unique. You bring a very unique perspective to building a team and to team culture. And what I'm also impressed by is that you don't just have ideas, but you've also implemented a lot of these. And you have been willing to talk about what's been working and what has been challenging. You've been very open about a lot of your personal challenges and struggles as well, all of which I find very inspiring and certainly something that I definitely hope to learn a lot from you about today. So welcome to the show.
Cool. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. You know, to get started, right, when you started at Voodoo, you had a blank slate. Your mandate was start a casual studio in a company that had been traditionally hyper-casual. Tell us about what were some of the first things you thought about as you were getting started. What were your first 7, 30, 60, 90 days looking like? And what was important to you in those early phases and what was not important?
Yeah, so when it actually happened, it was, I think, almost 2 years ago. And I do remember clearly that time because it was actually also a big transition for me. My whole background has been in casual games, and for sure, joining a company very exciting such as Voodoo, known very much for hyper-casual and in hyper-growth, was thrilling, exciting, and a bit scary. So that also, knowing this, having this in mind, that defined actually a lot my personal strategy on how I started there. So my first priority when I joined was really to understand the founders. So from the very beginning, I knew that I wanted to build a studio in Berlin, and I was in transition moving from Finland. So I was still working at Rovio when I left, and I was moving from Finland to Berlin, and I barely settled in Berlin, but I decided to spend 3 months in Paris immediately when I started, because I wanted to understand, first of all, the company. I wanted to spend some time with the co-founders, what was their mindset, what was their vision, because very little was discussed in details when I was hired, and that was fine. So we were aligned on the, I would say, high level vision, but I really wanted to understand what were the expectations, what were the fears, the concerns, what was the knowledge. So that was my priority at the beginning, to build the trust. And that may sound a bit, I would say, obvious, but it was not the case when we started, that they didn't know me. So I wanted them to understand more also about my vision and approach. So that was a lot through informal moments that could have been after work, drinks, events, crossing in the hallway, having a 5-minute conversation, having spontaneous chats. So a lot of this happened during these 3 months, and it was very critical that I have spent this time to build the trust, understand them, and build it the right way. So that was my very first priority. And in the meantime, as you pointed out in the article I wrote on the constructor of fun, for me, no matter what I felt that I could do, so as I use that time to explore more, okay, what is Voodoo strong about? What is their culture? What can I leverage as I build this team? And I don't have this answer, then I cannot build a team based on my future knowledge that I don't have right now, and it takes time to hire. So it became very clear for me that it was not so much about the games we would do, but how we would make them. And I established very early core fundamentals and values and mindset that were very important in the studio I would build to be able to navigate through the journey inside Voodoo. And to mention a few ones, for example, growth mindset was really one important for me, because with a growth mindset, you are okay and embrace the changes, the pivots, what you don't know today that you will know tomorrow. And some people enjoy that a lot. They want to grow, they want to learn, they are super open-minded, they will try things. And I absolutely wanted, for example, that kind of people from the very beginning, to be able to embrace the fact that maybe this is what we will do now, but in 3 months, we will do something different. So focusing more on the culture I wanted to build, and among other things, there was, for example, a team player. I wanted to build a team that was here for the win as a group and not as an individuals. So it's also very competitive, you know, in games, in hyper casual. And I didn't want this mindset where we will make a game that one can win and then exit, you know. So here we were really on a journey, maybe a long one together. And another point I had was about innovation. So I understood as well very quickly that if we start a casual studio in Voodoo, we cannot go by the same books as traditional casual studio like King, Rovio, Playrix. We have to find our own path. Mm-hmm. And that means as well exploration, innovation, understand what we could leverage from Voodoo, but also finding our path. And so towards the direction of innovation and creativity, I felt like it was really important to also have a good diversity, cognitive diversity in the team. And one of my core values as well with the team I stated early was what I call intellectual humility. So it's really valuing different viewpoints, seeing strength in it, seeing growth through it, rather than seeing it as a threat. So I wanted people who know how to work with other cultures or other people who think differently, and people who embrace it and love it. So a few things that, like I mentioned here, were really what defined how I hired at the beginning. And I spent time on this even before I started. And I spent time hiring properly people who would really embrace this mindset, because I trusted that the process, they would stick around and they would go through this wild, tough journey that was ahead of us, where I didn't even know what to expect. But I was trusting that the people would be there for the good reasons, because that's how they love to work.
Yeah. there's so much I want to dig into, especially the fact that your approach was not very conventional. You know, you spent time building relationships with the founders and defining the kind of values you wanted to have in the team, even before there was a team, even before there was a game, right? And, you know, for a number of other studios, I would imagine there would be, let's figure out what kind of game we want to build. Let's figure out who we're going to hire. Then, you know, a lot of the cultural aspects can come as an afterthought. So it's so interesting how you just approached it from the complete opposite end. So I'm curious though, you know, was there skepticism for this approach where you really took the time to figure out what kind of team would be that you would have before you went about actually building the team, right? Because again, when you have the mandate to build this new studio, clearly you have financial expectations, financial targets. So A, was there skepticism? And if yes, what were some of the things you said or did to address some of the reservations early on?
Yeah, so coming back also to the, what were the goals of, what was my mission more from the founders when I started? And of course, ultimately was to release a game and start to generate revenues from, so when I joined, it was 2019, so from end of 2020, so a year after. This is, of course, very ambitious because it takes time to build the team and then finding the game. And we know the success rate on releasing games, it's also very low. So I thought, okay, I have a very little buffer here for a target that is very ambitious. And so I thought really backwards from this goal of having the biggest odds to release a successful game end 2020, so even a game in soft launch. What do I need to ensure that I would be capable of doing that end of 2020? And I've been long enough in the industry to see that when you build things really fast, even a game or a team, and then things don't go well, and then people leave, it's even actually much more work and much longer to rebuild the team, refine. So I drew to for myself several scenarios where the worst one could be I hire really fast. I have people because they're in a journey that they don't even know about. I don't know about. They are frustrated. They leave. And I find myself in March 2020 with no team. I have to start over. And then very likely I will not reach my goal. So I was willing to invest really more from the beginning to ensure actually the long-term viability of a team. And that with a team, we would figure out like a smart team and really collective intelligence that we will figure out what is the best game that we should release, that we should test, and that could potentially be, you know, for success in casual for Voodoo. And back to your question about the skepticism, I can answer in general, there's always been skepticism to this approach for me in starting like to look more into people. But what I can say is, in the industry, we use a lot of short-term thinking. We look at what's happening in the next 3 months, next 6 months, and very little we think about 1, 2, 3 years, where in reality, everything you want to create takes at least 1 to 2 years. So when you start to think a bit longer, you realize that actually having a good tactic from the beginning or releasing something quick may not be the best tactic in the long term, but you can be lucky, of course, there. So I would say skepticism there is in general, and there was even before I joined Voodoo, but I didn't feel this way when I joined with the support of the founders, where I really explained to them, I tried to understand as well what were their vision, and they were really thinking long-term. Of course, I think the reality is founders always want to see long-term, but the reality hits hard where there's always pressure from external, you know, points like investors, and then they may have to think again short-term, mid-term. So it's always a balance. But from the beginning, in the principles, they were really happy to have me. They really believed in my vision. They hired me for this as well. And so they supported it, where I promised like under 6 months, I will build the team. So that's what I committed to. And they were okay with that. And I think this is where we could have a fine alignment from the beginning. So I didn't promise, for example, that I would build a team in 3 months. That was impossible.
Yeah. I like what you said about, you know, you could totally have moved fast, but that could actually mean more work if you move fast and make the wrong decision. I also I found it interesting that you built the relationship with the founders to make sure the expectations were aligned. You had the milestones defined, so everyone was clear. Right? And it's interesting, right? And it's also like you front-loaded a lot of the work of preparation, so you wouldn't have to scramble later. I'm reminded of this quote. It's perhaps apocryphal. I think it was Abraham Lincoln. A lot of quotes are attributed to him, but I think it goes like, give me 1 week to cut down a tree, and I'm going to spend like the first 6 days sharpening the axe. And I think that sounds very true here, right? Because you could just rush, but that isn't always the best. It's much better to sharpen the axe, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the analogy. It's very accurate.
Yeah. Right. So you had a timeline to start building out a team. And you did, you know, this was before you figured out what kind of product it would be, what kind of game it would be. So you had to make your first few hires who would be category agnostic or genre agnostics. Who were the first couple of hires?
Yeah. So it was not completely genre agnostic because I was a defining factor as well as I joined Voodoo by my own experience. So I worked on a lot of casual games. However, I didn't want to limit myself to let's hire just people who have worked on puzzle games. So my main experience has been on puzzle game. But what I consider myself that I've been expert on over the past years, and which was a good overlap with Voodoo, was the audience. I have a very good knowledge of what we call the casual audience, how, you know, they enjoy an experience, understand a bit more as well what are the motivations. So I wanted to double down on this knowledge, like really from a pure audience point of view. Also, another thing is there are many teams that were being formed not only at Voodoo, but in the industry, where they go for audience that could be more a hardcore strategy. And I felt like, what is the best positioning that I can have with my knowledge, with my view of the world? And I felt that it was very obvious that we would go for an audience that is a majority female, and also an audience that has a good overlap with maybe the audience of Voodoo Hypercasual. So that was, I would say, the defining factor if we have to think really of product kind of limitations. Mm-hmm. However, I was quite open when I started to hire people, where for me, I wanted to have a good mix of people who either already worked in free-to-play mobile games and others who didn't, because I wanted to create something new and different. So for example, for key product position, so my very first hire was a developer actually, because with my thinking, with a developer, we could already start to prototype. So I would say the first key position you can have is to have a developer. So you start to test your assumption, experiment, test your theories, and release things quickly. So with the first developer who's already today the tech lead, we prototyped, I think, 2-3 games during that time. We released it out there so I could learn the whole process of how to test marketability, how to make creatives myself. So I was just recording the gameplay, like very hyper-casual style, and putting it as a creative on Facebook, for example. So I learned the whole process of how to release a game. So that was a good training ground before others came. And very quickly came after key position, like for me, product position especially. So my colleague, Marco, so product manager, came, art lead, and designers, the first designer. So these people were really important to really consolidate what is the product vision, where are we going with the studio, where do we want to go. And then from this core, we expanded like more artists, more developers, more designers, producer. And today we are 14. But we started like really one person. We were for, I think, three, four months together. It was quite long. And then we became 5, and then we became 9, and now we are 14.
Interesting. I know we talked about how you took the time to think through things, but when it was the time to start hiring and moving, you also optimized the speed, where you were like, look, let's hire a developer so we can prototype quickly, we can test quickly, we can get something out quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an interesting way to see that, you know, just because you're front loading a lot of the thinking, it does not mean you're moving slowly at all.
Yeah, not at all. Actually, to come back to really the time I had a developer working with me prototyping, I could kill also some assumptions I had because it was just me thinking alone and thinking we could do this, that. So we could test quickly, and the learning we have had was the learning we used to actually start really the foundation of the studio when more people were here. And I could discard already some directions because I saw them not viable.
Yeah. You could validate a lot of the assumptions or invalidate them, which I imagine is just as important. Right? Yeah. And you started more than 2 years ago, and that is well before the pandemic. So if my somewhat rusty math serves me right, the pandemic hit a couple of months after you started. So what happened? What had to change in the way you were planning? What were some of the key challenges at the time?
Yeah, I remember actually very clearly because it was for sure something I haven't planned for. So I was really convinced that the team I wanted to build would be on site. We would have a lot of time together, interactions, even personal time to get to know each other, especially for the big journey we had. So I have planned a lot of this when everybody joined in March. So in March, we were suddenly 9 people. And I think we had one first week to experience the life at the office. And the week after, it was announcement of a lockdown. And I was, wow. Oh my.
Yeah.
So there were multiple challenges that were also personal and to acknowledge. I had people who moved country to come to Berlin to join the team, to join this journey. And they barely saw Berlin, or they barely met people in Berlin. So it was a bit of a shock for some of them. And actually, they all stayed in the end. They had a very strong resilience, growth mindset again, as I said. They committed to come. They committed to live the experience of an expat. So they tried the whole year. So that was one thing hard, I think, to balance the emotional state of people who were just starting the new job, come to a new country, things don't go according to the plan, and at the same time, a high demand on, okay, we need to prototype this, we need to launch this, we need to test this. And I didn't understand even that when it happened. So I had my plans of how we should structure the team, how we should go forward. But there were a lot of frictions and resistance at the beginning. And I didn't understand at that time. I thought it was, okay, maybe we are not aligned, but I completely missed the point. And I wrote about it in my personal introspective. But people were really stressed. Some of them were really stressed and they couldn't even, you know, take a step back and be able to project themselves further because they were just trying to survive. So once it clicked, actually, things got much better through the summer where I got better. So I took time for myself as well to take a step back, handle my own emotions, my fears of everyone, you know, like living, like the things I try to avoid by spending the time to really hire a team. And then I thought, okay, well, that was inevitable because everyone would leave given the circumstances. So of course I was really stressed. And when I started to let go a bit and let, okay, I have to let people decide, everyone, you know, is responsible so for their choice in their life, things got actually much easier because then I was in a position to listen, to support, to explain while staying calm and also keep the focus of the team towards what we were trying to build. And so the first 3 months really during the lockdown were really hard. And I think we went like in the stages of forming a team, if you know about it, like there's a storming phase. I think we went like full speed in the storming. We were really in it. So there were a lot of frictions, not to the point that they say, okay, I don't want to continue, but it was hard. People were trying to find their position, their responsibility. And then it started to fit slowly, organically, as people get more comfortable, the trust was built. We started to ship things together organically. And since then, you know, it's been a year, we are doing a religiously every week a retrospective. And that has helped a lot, you know, to really talk about the things that didn't go well and learn about each other, how we handle conflicts. And that created more trust inside the team, to trust that conflicts are not bad. We are a good team, people with good heart, and we will manage these frictions and we will get over it. And since then, there have been really that strong foundation and trust, where we have had tough moments during the year, but we get much stronger as a unit over time. So I think that was part of, I would say, the challenges I can think of. And of course, one comes more to the part of creativity and how do we brainstorm and mingle. We found solutions to meet in some way. So some were not always, like, if I may say, always like legally allowed by the government, but we found ways to stay connected as humans. That was really a need we had.
Yeah.
And brainstorming and being creative. And we used a lot of actually softwares and tools that could support this. And one example I can give to simulate a bit our office life, we have used Discord. So basically everyone is hanging out in their virtual room like they would be at their desk. So you don't ask permission to talk to someone. You just jump in the room and say, hey, I need to talk to you about this. And then you're already talking. So that has helped a lot to simulate a bit office life, office conversation, and many other tools we use like this.
Yeah, certainly. It sounds like there was a lot of emotional upheaval, because not just because of the pandemic, because a lot of folks had just moved to Berlin. And I can see that they were like, I forget who said this, but it's, you know, the number of variables in your life is somewhat proportional to the amount of stress you have. So in this case, there was the new city, the new company, new game, and the pandemic. So that's, I can imagine, can just make for a lot of stress. And it sounds like it took you by surprise just as well, much like it took everybody, right? And it took you a while to sort of figure out what was going on, but eventually you guys came out stronger because you took the time to figure out what was happening and how to cope with it as a team. Also, just to switch gears a bit, you know, you talked about how you were tasked with building a casual studio in a hyper-casual company. And I imagine if you, you know, this that can come with cultural challenges, because there's specific ways of doing things in a hyper-casual company and completely different ways of operating in casual, right? And I know you can speak to a lot of the specifics much more eloquently than I can. So tell us a bit more about some of the challenges in just by virtue of the fact that these were very, very different genres.
Yeah. So I think the first main difference is really the business model. So hyper-casual really operate on, well, games that can scale a lot with a low cost of acquisition and revenue mostly through ads. And casual games traditionally are more from IAP. And of course, the cost of acquisition can be crazy if you are in a very competitive market. So I think this was, at least from a pure business model point of view, a root of many differences we had, even when we had to compare. So of course, it's very natural as a company to compare the performance and the velocity of the teams working on hyper-casual and casual. And it took time for really the founders, the leadership, to really not compare things that couldn't be compared. So to give an example, hyper-casual game could be released in a week, and then within a month, you're done. You put all the things that you need, like SDK, ads, you're ready to go, and you can start to be profitable from the month after, in the best case, right?
Yeah.
A casual game, it's impossible to make it in a week, release it, and be profitable just a few days after. This is a complete different model where, if you're familiar with the model, sometimes you pay a lot upfront, and only a year after you see the money back. And only the year after you are profitable, like you start to make profit, you know. So it's a different model. And what were the challenges then behind that was, first, velocity. So of course, there were sometimes the questions of, like, why is it taking so long? Not understanding, like, what are all these people doing? So in a team of 9 compared to a team of 3 in hyper casual, really not understanding the depth of game development, because it's much more complex when you create something that has to last for a year than something that can last for a month, you know. Even the system and the thinking behind is different. So I think it was a bit of an adjustment to understand this difference in the velocity and team size. And second, I think, was really understanding where ads could play a part in casual games. Because when you only know ads, and I think it's a great opportunity for revenues, that was, I think, new for Voodoo as well, to, as a hyper-casual company, to even understand the value of IAP revenues you make in a game, what it is to build an economy, meta progression. These things are never discussed in a hyper-casual game. So it was a lot of back and forth to really give, and that was also a lot on my end and my work, to give a visibility, and I would say also education, of what are we spending on time on. It's something that I wouldn't have to justify in a traditional casual company. But how are we spending our time? What do we need to build? Why is it important? And actually spending time with data and forecast to really show the numbers. And if you look at the LTV projection model, you see that the biggest leverage to really have a high LTV is retention. So then it's not so much about adding a ton lots of ads from the beginning, but okay, you can do that from the start. But what is really important is having a product that can really engage players for a long time, because that's what makes your prediction solid. Otherwise you have nothing, you know? So it took some time, really adjustment. And I would say it's really from the past 6 months really that we found our way a bit more, thanks to more data people, analysts who join to help create the language, the communication, the common communication to show through forecast, business model, what are we doing here? Because I think what I underestimated, for me, it's so obvious, I've worked most of my life in this model, but probably for the co-founders, they couldn't make sense of it, even whatever I could explain. So we had to find a common language more through a financial model to understand what is a casual game.
Yeah. Now that you explain it that way, you know, I realize how much of a difference there is, right? Just from the LTV curves to the velocity of, like, just building the game itself, right? So, and just how the monetization curves, the retention curves are shaped are just so radically different. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine if all they are used to is making bouncing ball apps that make money back within a week, but also just don't have that longer shelf life or have a relatively lower probability of success longer term. I can imagine how they would be like, why do you need 9 people and a year to put out a game? And you could just run marketability tests right out of the gate to release it in a week, right? So it sounds like how you address that was really over-communicating from the get-go, really explaining. And it sounds like a lot of that was just really noticing that a lot of people needed that kind of understanding and education about what somebody in a casual game company would just take for granted.
Yes. And it's really interesting also for me that learning from hyper-casual business model, I think I have incorporated really some very good concepts of it into how I make a casual game. And I think that's what makes it so special, how we created a casual game inside Voodoo.
Yeah. Other examples that come to mind of elements that could have been borrowed from hyper-casual to casual?
I think, for example, when marketability is essential, when you want to have your hyper-casual game succeed, I think in casual games, I think now there's more awareness, but it's a part that has been overlooked sometimes over the past years. And we approach it from the same angle from the very beginning. So we went with a very rough prototype. We made creatives out of it. We tested it in our target market to see even just the ballpark of the marketability. And of course, we know that it's not a guarantee that it will stay there because it's with an early prototype. But at least we know it starts on a range that is acceptable and not like at, I don't know, $8, $11, where we know let's just drop the idea. There's no way that we can make it back, you know. So I think testing with the marketability early on of your concept of the idea of the game is very valuable.
Certainly.
Yeah, and second, I think ads. I have never considered the potential of them until I could see numbers of how it looks like in hyper-casual games.
Yeah.
And I think it's still underestimated because maybe I truly believe that audience, well, are getting bigger. There are people who are adopting more the interaction with ads and actually value it. And what can, you know, more mature game looks like when, if, you know, it could be more incorporated. And that's what I've been exploring as well with. It's very interesting because it definitely changes some beliefs I had about ads working casual games. So I updated actually my view about it and my knowledge about it by trying different things. So integration in our game as well.
Certainly, right. Sounds like you were also open to everything you could learn from what was out there in the hyper-casual culture, right? So, you know, again, you talked about how you communicated and over-communicated as much as you could. But I imagine when you're working with a large company, when you're a small studio in a large company, trying to build something very different from what the core company is doing, I imagine there can still be reservations or skepticism. I imagine it could also just be multiple, just because there are multiple people within the leadership team, extended leadership team. I can speak to some of that because I was a part of a 5-member studio that was acquired by a public company, and I can speak to some of that. But I'm curious, in your case, right? I imagine that they can have it somewhat. I can see how there can be a lot of questions asked, a lot of reservations. So, how did you uncover any reservations, spoken or unspoken, that people might have had? That could be questioning your work.
Yeah, so of course it has happened. And again, it comes back really to, I learned a lot actually last year to, I would say a part I could say self-management, emotional management, because it can of course be perceived quickly as an attack, as a threat, and people are questioning your existence. Like, why are you here again? So I did have some conversation like that, and not necessarily with founders. It's, we have an AMA every week, like a question asked to the CEO very openly, anonymously, on a weekly digest. And some questions come once in a while, like, what are the casual teams doing? They've been working on a game for X months. When do we see something they release? Was it a good investment? So they're really hard questions sometimes to read. And of course, the CEO is always happy to answer and talk about long-term things. So I think here was really patience was really a thing. So for us, especially as a studio, was really important that first I trust my work, I trust where I'm going. And that was not always the case. There was some moments a bit in the dark, but trusting, like, what do I know? What do I believe in? What do I not know? And I should verify ASAP. And with the team also believing the same thing and keeping like sharp focus on doing our test, making progress, not be too affected by the judgment, the skepticism, because that's part of life.
Sure.
And over time, when finally we started to have results, so I think it was end of last year. So when we launched our game, we had our D1. It was very early test, low. So when I say low, it was, around 30% something. In the end, I would say not great, and in some cases, you would even kill the game at this point. But that was our early test. And in these moments, we already made the scenario that we would at least try for 1 to 3 months to really correct the early funnel, because we know these points are really hard at the beginning, and we cannot have it right from the first time. But for example, the company was like, okay, if it's that low, why spending that much time to fix it? It's like, either you fix it or you don't, and you move on, you know? So then we had to, I think we kept really the focus on, okay, let's forget about the deadline here. What do we need to do now? How much time will we have, and what can we do in this short time? So we did really drastic changes to pivot the game, to really analyze correctly, do a maximum of player research. And then when we released and we had our changes really significant that saved the game, then we started to have attention positively. Okay, this team, they know what they're doing. Maybe we didn't give them the time and the credit to prove that, but they proved through a test that they can change really the fate of the game after 2-3 playtests, you know. And that's what we continued on doing when there were some moments a bit of low, like, okay, maybe the CPI is like this, maybe the monetization is like this. We understand quickly, we analyze, we make our assumptions, we release quickly, and then we turn around our numbers. So I think over time now, after we've done that multiple times, trust started to build and they started to understand, okay, actually this team has different skills, different competencies, but since everybody speaks the same language in this company, which is data, through data, this is how we started to have actually also more the recognition from other teams because data spoke for us, you know. But when it was just pure development, it was really hard to have a buy-in because I understand it's a different language. Where hyper-casual, you get your results quickly, you know. You don't have to evaluate the quality of a game by playing it. You just look at the numbers. Casual games, you don't have that for a year sometimes. You're in the dark.
Yeah. I imagine that can be nerve-wracking because it certainly sounds like you were building against the clock. Mm-hmm. And right. And, you know, when your first early numbers aren't great and you're like, rats, we have to go back to the drawing board. I can't imagine how much pressure that can have felt like. Yeah, I know you spoke about, look, there were people asking questions, maybe in some of the all hands and so on and so forth. But I'm curious if there were also conversations you had to have to address any reservations that people had, right? Like people questioning, oh, is the casual game shipping? And you're like, was there a conversation? Was there a somewhat critical conversation that comes to mind that you can speak about and can share?
Mm-hmm. I think I did two important things that first restored my confidence in what we were doing here and why. So the first one was really having a direct conversation with the CEO. So I found myself, I think it was the end of the year, as we closed the year, it was really a hard year for us. We were not sure of continuing with the game, but we managed to turn around the numbers. So, you know, a lot of things were happening. And I took the time to reflect and I wrote a big retrospective of my year. How was my experience from a team located in Berlin, far from the Paris office headquarters, and how things were perceived on my end, and really giving the feedback to the CEO. So we had that conversation and I told him, like, look, I would like us really to discuss this because maybe I'm missing some point, maybe I'm confused on some points. I really need to understand, have clarity, visibility, where we're heading to, what do you expect from me, from us, so I can navigate better and actually execute the goals you expect from me. So there was a realignment discussion at the beginning of the year directly with CEO, first for me to understand what is my perception or fears that I imagine on my end because I'm isolated in Berlin with my team. And where is the reality? And the reality is in the voice of the CEO, right? So that has helped a lot. And I think it gave awareness for him as well that where he thought we were fine, he realized actually we were going through a really hard time. And giving support was actually important and maybe a responsibility he could take to, you know, help us to succeed here and not just let us be. And then we have to fight to prove that we exist and also to succeed, you know. So that was the first thing. And second was really, I think it was a month ago when we started to actually have real progress to give an update in front of the whole company, like a retrospective. That's what we've done. That's how we turn around the game numbers. That's what we've been working on and why it took that time. So giving full transparency as well to the company in a presentation, all hands meeting, for really for them to understand that, yeah, we exist, we're doing this, and giving more of a context because people in the end were not really had bad intentions. But when people are curious, you know, they just didn't understand coming from hyper-casual teams. They really missed information and transparency. And actually, that was much better too. And I realized that as well. It's we are not maybe on from the same point of view, and we may not see the same things. And maybe my responsibility here is to give more visibility to the rest of the company in what we're doing. Right. So handling a better internal communication as well.
Yeah. And I want to also underscore how, you know, just taking the initiative to have both those conversations, to provide the full retrospective, and also to have that sort of candid conversation with your CEO, that's not obvious and not easy, right? And I can also see what you said about the CEO almost assuming everyone's going to be fine, because that's a mistake I've made. We have a very small team, but it's certainly a mistake I've made in assuming, and we're also we're a small team and we're fully remote. And there's times when I've just assumed things are okay. And one of the lessons I've learned is to really over-communicate with the team and just check in and make sure and tell them everything is okay when, you know, because yeah, I also tend to be very, very optimistic as a person. So I just tend to assume everything is fine. Whereas I've learned somewhat of a hard way that not everybody thinks that way. Yeah, I can totally see how courageous and how important those conversations can have been for you, right? And, you know, of the first conversation with the CEO, how were you, and also when you were clearly interfacing with a lot more stakeholders than your team was. So you were clearly getting a lot of these, the skepticism, the curiosity, you know, the questions, you were confronting a lot of that. What were you sharing with your team? And how is this impacting your team?
So of course, when there were comments in the AMA, all the team could see it. And sometimes, so we have our own internal, so AMA inside the team, and we have open conversations where I think it's important for me that there's really the feeling of safety in my team. So they were bringing up sometimes like, do we have the support of the company? It feels like maybe they are not, or it seems like people are questioning what we're doing. So they were asking me, what do I think about it? So I think in this moment, I really shared what I think. So what was my position and what I believed in. And I had really really confidence and trust in what we were doing, but that was not necessarily shared across the company. But nevertheless, I said, like, that's the confidence I have. I believe in what we're doing. It's just a matter of time. So at least it was reassuring on that part that at least, you know, one of us here has has confidence to also inspire confidence in others. However, I was also very transparent about explaining here the context. Like, you know, it's a hyper casual, like traditional company, and where they come from, that's what they value, that's what they see, that's what they know. It doesn't make them bad. So trying to explain, and I would say here, give at least have the team to have a bit more empathy as well for the leadership or the other teams, because we are also in our little bubble of what we understand we're doing, but it's not the case for other teams. So what I was explaining really here is what I just told you, is like the only way we will be recognized is through the universal language that happens in these companies, through data. So we have to prove results. So let's focus our time, our energy in making a great game. Be patient. Let's make it happen, and then things will follow. But let's not try to convince in the process as we're doing it, because it will be just hard. And they understood that. Of course, it's disappointing and they were sad, but I'm really happy how my team as well is really mature about that and understanding, like, you know, okay, fine. Let's use our energy to really build this game and prove, you know, what we're doing here. And that has helped a lot. So yes, there were some disappointments, but again, like out of maturity, they really understood as well, you know, to not judge too quickly.
Certainly. Right. And this is something you mentioned a couple of times today, which is you focused on building a common language, which was data. You focused on understanding with the other stakeholders and with your own team. I think you had the conviction that this game could work, and it wasn't just like blind conviction. Mm-hmm. It's because this is certainly not your first rodeo. You've seen enough games, and I imagine that conviction is born of your experience, knowing, oh, this thing is going to work. Mm. And yeah, you said you did say your game's in soft launch, if I understand correctly, right? So it's going to be approaching global launch sometime soon, I imagine. So when you look back in hindsight through this journey, what were some mistakes, for want of a better word, or what are some of the things you felt you could have done differently along this journey?
I think one main thing, and I think it hit us hard actually in the development, was really the share of proven versus innovation. So I had a team that is very creative, very diverse. So they come with a lot of ideas, they have a lot of inspiration. And I think here the mistake, and we did talk about it, we analyzed it and we tried to not repeat it too much now in our future development, was we were forming the team as we were building a new product. And some choice we made were really maybe more forming the team than actually serving the product, because it made our life harder, where we innovated in some areas, not saying looking back that it was the wrong choice, but it definitely extended our development time, made our life harder, and was putting us to have even harder times to justify the development. So I think the mistake here was not how we approach the development of this game, but was it maybe Marder's game to go for as the very first game to ship in a studio forming. So that, I think that is one thing that I still reflect on today, but we are happy because now the choice we made early that were bringing us problems are actually the opportunity that allow us to maybe launch today, because then the game is different, unique, very novel. Yeah, so it turned around quite well for us. But in these moments where we were thinking really of killing the game because it was just too complex, you know, yeah. I was really thinking, was it the smartest choice to start with this, you know, particularly? Yeah.
And some of this is only obvious in hindsight, I would think, right? But yeah. And also along these months, what were some of the things that were the most surprising to you? Yeah.
I think the main thing that was the most surprising is that ads can make revenue. I think that's the thing I really discarded it, and I was really an organization that really were anti-ads, and I cannot be anti-ads being at Voodoo in a hyper-casual company. So until I actually worked on it and see value in it, that was, I think, the thing that surprised me because finding myself valuing it actually is something I didn't expect.
I can imagine, right? So certainly a number of game developers that have worked in casual or somewhat traditional games, I can see ads can be almost an afterthought, certainly. Sophie, I'm just thinking back about the last couple of minutes, that many minutes that he's spoken. There's so much that you've spoken about, that's so much that I feel like I've learned from you just in the last hour or so. This is perhaps a good place for us to start to wrap. I do want to thank you for the openness and transparency with which you've told your story. It's certainly something I find very, very inspiring. Thank you. But of course, before we let you carry on, would you tell folks how they can find out more about you and everything you do?
Yeah, I would say the best way is LinkedIn personally for me. Yeah. And I started at the beginning of the year an initiative that is very dear to me about conscious leadership and a masterclass called Rise and Play. So you can check it as well on riseandplay.io. And you have a lot of the things I have shared about today that are maybe more practical for you if you are also in a position of leadership.
Wonderful. We will link to all of that, including riseandplay.io or the masterclasses. Some of them are free, correct?
Or yeah, they are all free. They're all free.
Yeah. They're all free, and you've offered them in the spirit of sharing. Certainly, we will link to all of that, Sophie. But for now, thank you so much for being on the Mobile User Acquisition Show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, and I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Mobile User Acquisition Show. If any of this was helpful or instructive, I would love for you to leave us a review or rating on iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcast fix. This podcast takes a ton of time, effort, and love to produce, and I deeply value every review and every piece of feedback that you share. Thank you for listening, and I will look forward to sharing our next episode soon.